Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Stephen Mansfield is a New York Times best author who is becoming one of the nation's most respected voices on religion in American culture. He's the author of The Faith of George Bush, The Faith of Barack Obama. He wrote a book on Booker T. Washington and also on Winston Churchill. Stephen Mansfield, welcome to LifeQuest.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
What prompted you or motivated you to write a book on Oprah and more specifically on the spiritual journey of this lady?
Well, as you know, I write books on sort of the intersection between faith and culture, you know, the faith side of politics, the faith side of American history and leadership and so on. And, you know, Oprah's been written about from many perspectives, a broadcast perspective and an African-American woman perspective and so on. But I think she's one of the most influential religious figures of our time. And that's not only in, because of, you know, the size of her audience and what people call the Oprah effect, but also because of her sort of bringing together different streams of what some folks call New Age or alternative spirituality. So I wanted to capture that, tell that story, and use it as a vehicle for creating a debate on, you know, what we might call syncretism, or this idea that, you know, all religions are one, heading in the same direction, and we can sort of pick one from column A, two from column B, put them together, and have a valid, meaningful religion. So that was my motive.
Well, to the average television viewer, of Oprah, do you think that they would kind of identify her in the context that you're talking about here as a spiritual or a religious leader?
Well, many of them will not, and the reason is that they tend to think of her brand of spirituality as being more about self-empowerment, more about self-improvement and achievement. And also, Oprah, for those who are devoted fans and followers of the show, Oprah makes a pretty big distinction between religion and spirituality. She says you can keep your religion, have your religion, be a Baptist, be a Mormon, be a Buddhist, be whatever you are, but then let's talk about spirituality. Let's talk about meditation, chanting, visualization. Let's talk about karma and mantras. So she distinguishes the two, and for those who accept that, they wouldn't think that she is a religious leader. They would think that she is a spiritual person who's teaching people how to be empowered. They wouldn't define that as religion, but of course, the case I make in the book is that it's all basically the same thing.
Yeah, it's a false premise.
Exactly. If you have a religion, and it is one of the traditional religions, so to speak, if it's a religion that includes a vision or an understanding of the supernatural, as, for example, Christianity or Judaism, et cetera, then that religion includes an understanding of spirituality. And to say that you can do a traditional religion on Sunday mornings, so to speak, and then do spirituality of a completely opposite kind in the rest of your life is just to create sort of a religious schizophrenic. And I think that's why a lot of her audience would say, hey, she's not a religious leader, she's just a spiritual person. Mm-hmm. But they really are the same thing.
Now, you call your book, Where Has Oprah Taken Us? But why don't you take us a little bit as to the background of her faith? Where does she come from in her journey?
Well, it's a very interesting path. You know, she was born to a rural black family, of course, in Mississippi. Ended up living in Detroit for a while with her mother when her mother moved there from the South. But the real hero of her story is a man named Vernon Winfrey, who obviously not only gave her his name, but it was her father, not her biological father, but certainly her father figure.
Yes.
Deep Christian, committed Baptist. Nashville, Tennessee, and really raised her in a very conservative, theologically conservative, biblically based Baptist world. It was in the church that she first made her speeches, and the church that she first, hit her stride as a personality, a broadcaster, a person in public view. And that pretty much continued with her until she got into her late 20s. By that time, she was in Baltimore. She had been sent out there or hired out there to be the co-anchor of a news show with a kind of a Walter Cronkite figure who was a real legend out in that area, and it failed miserably. It was humiliating and embarrassing, and she was so stressed she began to lose her hair. Now, the reason I'm setting all this up is that during that time, she went to church. Now, this is going to be hard for you to believe, but it's so well documented. She said it herself. She went to her church, which was an African Methodist Episcopal church,
yes.
And her pastor spoke on God being a jealous God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she misinterpreted it. She misunderstood it. She concluded that he was saying that God was jealous of her. And later she said, well, how could the God who flung the stars into the sky be jealous of me? Well, of course, that's not what that verse means. It's not what the pastor meant. God is jealous for you. He's jealous for you to be his and not belong to other gods and false theologies and what have you. Well, she said that she rejected it at that point, and then almost the exact quote is, at that point I went out to seek my own spiritual self, my own spirituality. And that turning point, odd as it is, and based on a rather easy-to-explain misunderstanding, is what set her in the direction of kind of motivational accomplishment, self-empowerment, you know, believe it, conceive it, achieve it kind of thinking that got merged into the New Age movement, you know, in the 70s, and we've all seen the results of that since.
Now, that is when it began to change. It became far more public as her present-day program on television developed.
Yes, exactly. In 1994, she turned 40. She was wealthy already and famous, and she had about a three-day birthday party with a bunch of her friends, and she was troubled because she was being accused of being sort of the slime queen of daytime television. Everybody remembers the kinds of shows she would do about sex and violence and sex changes and all that kind of thing. And so she began to want to do a more elevated show. Some folks at that birthday party said, well, maybe you ought to lead the world in prayer with the Pope, which kind of makes me chuckle, I have to say. But then she decided that she did want to stop doing the sort of slimy shows and do shows on spirituality. And so she began to bring onto her show the spiritual teachers, authors, some would call them gurus, who had been significant to her over the previous 20 years or so. And that's when the private Oprah Winfrey spirituality became the spirituality that shaped her show for years. And it was exciting to a lot of her audience, but it was unbelievably controversial. And I think it helped to shift American society into very much an eclectic kind of religious pastiche, New Age kind of direction. And that's, of course, you know, the basis for the book.
And yet I would suppose that many of her viewers, average American, in many cases housewives, would be somewhat shocked to be confronted with, but Oprah's not a Christian.
Well, and I think you're exactly right. And the reason is that she uses the name of Jesus. She talks about God. She talks about church. She, you know, if something's kind of goofy or funny, she go, oh, Lord, you know, kind of kind of black church style. And I attend an African-American, largely African-American church in D.C., and you know, I find all that to be warm and loving. But in the same way that Francis Schaeffer once said that liberalism, theological liberalism, is humanism in theological clothing, the New Age movement does exactly the same thing with Christian language. It's alternative spirituality that takes Christian language and drains it of its original meaning and puts a kind of an alternative spirituality meaning to it. So she'll talk about Jesus. She'll talk about sin, sort of. She'll talk about the Bible or God or getting saved or repenting. And when you really drill down and listen and then hold it up against everything else she believes, you realize that she's not believing those words in the sense that you and I might mean them.
So her definition of salvation, if that word ever came up, might be quite different than mainstream evangelical Christians.
If she ever used that word, what she would mean would be enlightenment. What she would mean would be the aha moment spiritually. She would mean, she believes that there's this sort of cosmic divine spirit, and to the extent that we are permeated by it, led by it, shaped by it, healed by it, empowered by it, you know, that's the extent to which we're engaging the divine. Well, you know, so when she talks about, she would probably never use the phrase getting saved, but if she did use the phrase, or the word salvation, she would mean when you come to that understanding, when you are illuminated afresh, or you first realize that you are divine. I mean, she once said that gurus don't come to introduce us to the divine, they come to teach us that we are divine. And that's how she thinks. And so, yes, if she's using Christian language, believe me, what's happening in her mind is not what's happening in the mind of a biblical Christian.
So, in fact, the answers are within oneself, guided by external teachers.
Yes. And Jesus, by the way, in this scheme, is nothing more than a man who simply learned to manifest this divine spirit more than others. He's just one of many New Age gurus, but believe me, according to that theology, he's not the Son of God, he's not, you know, not seated at the right hand of God now, etc.
Now, you use the term synchristic, this kind of mixture of various faiths and religions and philosophies. She seems to have avoided Scientology and the Kabbalah, though maybe I missed some of those programs. But, you know, how does this affect the average viewer? I mean, that seems to be the premise of what you're saying in your book, is that it's actually affected American culture, spiritual culture.
Well, there's no question that it has, and I think that what's interesting, is that sad, rather, you know, I love the church. I love the church in America, but I have to say that we tend to be a mile wide and inch deep, and
yeah.
We tend to not be very theological, and we tend to run high on personality and sentiment and feeling and emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the interesting dynamic here is that much of Oprah's audience, you know, is African-American church-going women.
Right.
And I don't mean to just pick on African-Americans, although I've already said I go to a largely African-American church in D.C.
Yeah.
It's also white women. It's also men. The bottom line is that, you know, the people would listen to her, and because she drove this wedge in their understanding between religion and spirituality, they would think, oh, she's just teaching us mantras as a way to empower ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And because we hadn't been well taught, and, you know, most pastors are doing well just to cover the Ten Commandments, much
right.
less teach what Hinduism is or Buddhism or whatever, you know, they just kind of drank it in. And that's what's happened with our culture. You know, I did an interview earlier today, and the hostess said, yeah, I consider myself kind of a Christian Buddhist. Well, see, that's what's resulted from this. People are merging
right.
religions, probably at a practical sort of discipline, spiritual practices level, that have completely different worldviews. And, you know, when people are not thinking in the totality of what those religions maintain, then they can follow Oprah into a, you know, kind of Chinese menu, one from column A, two from column B kind of thing.
Yeah. I've got to tell you, Stephen, I remember in a church I pastored in Oregon where a lady stopped coming, and I visited the family, and I said, were you attending? Well, we're attending over here because the pastor makes me cry. And I thought, I'm sorry, I didn't make you cry. That becomes the definition of whether this is a good place to be spiritually, is whether the emotions are totally opened up.
Well, and that is. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from the intellectual content of these spiritual gurus, which, of course, is, you know, important and you know, I would think dangerous. But it's also, I want to just say that I've interviewed a dozen or two of them at least on for this book, and I have to say, nice people. We laughed, we joked, they cared about me.
Mm-hmm.
They had to know who I was, not because I'm, you know, super famous, but just because a simple visit to my site, my
yes.
website by a staffer would have identified, you know, basically who I am. So they still talked out on the phone, spent time with me, very gracious, very engaging personalities. And that's part of the problem. If that's all there is to it,
mm-hmm.
if salvation's about being nice, you know,
yeah.
well, then why did Jesus come? You know, and so obviously we need to be loving and sweet and nice. I mean, that's what we're called to do, and you know, we can thunder about truth when the time is right. But we can't have a religion that's all about sweetness and light, for heaven's sakes.
I was going through your book and the history here of the various people who were very important in her life and that affected Oprah's thinking. It was a really fascinating, but in some way, using the word shocking is important to see in what ways people have influenced her greatly.
Well, that is one of the dynamics, and I know I probably sound more insulting about Oprah on this subject than anything else. I think she's a gifted woman, a gifted interviewer. I think she's a brilliant businesswoman, but I don't know that she's very intellectually astute. And I think that when she hears these different, and she's also a needy soul, so she's very influenced by these teachers, and she doesn't have the, again, I don't want to be insulting, but she doesn't have the training or
mm-hmm.
the sharp enough mind to recognize that she's merging together completely distinct, even opposite worldviews. And so, you know, again, most of these New Age teachers she hangs with really are growing some variety of Hinduism. Well, Hinduism is completely opposite of biblical Christianity.
Yes.
You cannot; they're not even in the same universe, and yet she thinks there's, you know, again, it's that sort of theosophical all roads lead to God kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and so I think that that's not only why she's easily influenced, but why she gets on the air with such excitement about an idea that's been around, you know, like since the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
And then, of course, she persuades people because she's an engaging personality.
One of the lessons I'm beginning to pick up here is discernment. You suggest that maybe she doesn't have a lot of discernment in these things. Oh, this sounds good. This is persuasive. But that's a good lesson for all of us Christians, right?
Absolutely. You know, we just cannot turn off our minds. We cannot let emotion persuade us. And we cannot let, you know, let ourselves get pulled into things uncritically. And, Paul told Timothy, watch your life and doctrine closely.
Right.
Well, that's a command for everybody, not just folks who are in the pastorate. And we've seen a lot of damage done. I mean, you know, you and I could go from this conversation to a discussion of Rob Bell and universalism or a lot of other theologies that are creeping in, excesses in the charismatic Pentecostal movements, which is kind of my background religiously. Mm-hmm. You know, we could talk about all kinds of things. All of them come down to solid doctrine and lovingly holding the ground of the high ground of, you know, the faith once for all delivered to the saints.
I do a program of simply going through the Bible, and I've been amazed recently reading again with another pastor as we talk on the air about how much emphasis there was from St. John and St. Paul, watch out for these false teachers. And that was over and over in the first century. How much more today?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. In fact, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I have been saying to frequently in conjunction with this book that I think actually what we're doing here as a culture is cycling back into the spiritual nature of the Roman Empire, very much back in those days. And, of course, the good news is that the true gospel can dominate, can win, can persuade souls in that kind of environment. But you have to be able to distinguish. You have to be able to discriminate. And, you know, one of the values that is a little misguided in the church is a misunderstanding of what it means in Scripture when it says don't judge.
Uh-huh.
You know, of course we're going to judge. You know, I often joke, if your 16-year-old daughter is going out with some guy and he comes over to pick her up, judge him.
Yes.
You know, of course you're going to judge.
Right.
And so we need to not conclude that what Jesus said is, you know, total tolerance and to each his own and don't ever cross like it. In fact, we're told in Scripture to confront each other and rebuke each other and take somebody else if they won't listen and, you know, police the house, so to speak. And I think that that we've become a little bit weak because we've assumed that what Jesus meant is just leave everybody to their own. Well, that's the exact opposite of the tenor of the New Testament.
And Stephen, I had here in my notes, I was going to ask you, what is the antidote, but you've just given it. And that is good Bible reading, good Bible teaching, and remembering our foundation and fundamentals as Christians.
That's absolutely true, and you know, I have to say, I'm not a guy to beat on the church or criticize pastors, but I think we all know that most pastors, as I say kind of sarcastically, are doing good just to cover some of the biblical basics.
Mm-hmm.
Most churches are not real deep in teaching, doctrine or history or false religions or anything else. And I think the evidence is in statistics like, you know, Mormonism is the fastest growing religion in America,
yeah.
And it grows to a tune of about 70% out of the pews of Christian churches.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you start throwing stats like that out, it's very, very obvious that we are good at generating what some would call religious excitement. We're not good at making disciples. We're not good at getting people biblically grounded. We're not good at helping them to understand the many cautions in the New Testament about false teachers, false doctrines, deceiving spirits, things like that. Now, we don't want to turn everybody into paranoid heresy hunters,
mm-hmm.
but just a normal part of the normal Christian life is that you got your guard up a little bit, that you're checking things, you're running them through a biblical filter. And you know, the reason that that's so important, I was just reading this morning in my chronological Bible daily reading of the Old Testament, you know, some of these practices that you can get led into, sometimes even in the church, are things God calls abominations,
right.
Things he destroyed whole kingdoms over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want to take this stuff lightly. And I think that the price of vigilance is certainly worth it, and the fact that we haven't been vigilant has led us to the sometimes weak and inconsequential church that we see today.
And isn't it interesting, what you're describing here is the fact that there's nothing new under the sun.
No.
This has been around for thousands of years.
Oh, sure. I mean, how many times does a teaching on these subjects take us back to the simple statement, ye shall be as gods?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that really, we're just basically cycling around the same old things. You know, Ecclesiastes 1 says there's nothing new under the sun. You know, Harry Truman said the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. And I think that that's a helpful statement, because these things have all been around before. you and I could start now on a two-hour conversation about how almost every kind of New Agey religion today has its parallel in the Roman, first-century yes. Roman Empire. And the Christians confronted it then, knocked it in the head, so to speak, and moved on. And then we let it cycle back, and we act like it's some kind of new revelation for our
right.
times that needs to be somehow blended with the gospel to be culturally relevant. So I don't mean to be sarcastic or harsh. I just think that, I think the gospel's true. And I think that, sometimes, again, somebody with a literally straight face this morning on the air saying to me, I'm a Christian Buddhist. I mean, the
yeah.
level of ignorance, violence to the gospel, lack of full devotion to Jesus contained in that statement is stunning, and I don't think it's that unusual.
At the end, or in the epilogue of your book, Where Has Oprah Taken Us, you do say, but let's remember her story isn't over yet.
Exactly. I don't think anybody's story is over yet unless mm-hmm. They're in the grave. And
yes.
I think that she, there are some things we know about her, right? God loves her. She has a purpose that God created her for. I think that we see that purpose some in her life, although it's certainly marred, like it is in all of our lives until we get cleaned up by Jesus. And I'd like to see that story turn. I'd like to see some good Christians be of influence in her lives and in her life and turn her a bit. And I think she found what she took to be empowerment in a New Age worldview and practice. But I know there are some good, solid Christians in her life, the Winans, and I think that Vince Gill and Amy Grant are often with her and things mm-hmm. like that. Well, may the Lord empower them to be, to have real open doors with her. And who knows, maybe this will turn yet. We'll see Oprah Winfrey saying, man, I dabbled in some stuff that wasn't true, but I found out that Jesus is not just another enlightened one. He's the Christ, the Son of the living God. And if we can hear that, I think it'll be awesome. So I don't think the jury's come in on anybody yet
yes.
who's still living and for whom God is still reaching.
The book is Where Has Oprah Taken Us by Stephen Mansfield. It's a Thomas Nelson publication. Stephen, is the book on the shelves now?
It is. It releases this week. We're doing one of the first interviews right now. And so, yes, of course, it's always available on Amazon, if not mm-hmm. anywhere else, but it should be in most major bookstores around the country.
Stephen, thanks for being on LifeQuest today.
Always great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net or write to LifeQuest at P.O. Box 33082, Knoxville, Tennessee 37930.